We would like to acknowledge that the land which we are gathered on today is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe Nation, specifically the Chippewa Tri-Council, comprised of the Chippewas of Beausoleil, Rama, and Georgina Island First Nations, and more recently, the Mississaugas of the Credit River First Nation. Ontario is covered by 46 treaties and other agreements and is home to many Indigenous nations from across Turtle Island, including the Inuit and the Métis. These treaties and other agreements, including the One Dish with One Spoon Wampum Belt Covenant, are agreements to peaceably share and care for the land and its resources. Other Indigenous nations, Europeans, and newcomers were invited into this covenant in the spirit of respect, peace, and friendship. Most of us have come here as settlers, immigrants, or newcomers in this generation or generations past. We are all treaty people. Every day, we are mindful of broken covenants, and we strive to make this right. We commit to collaborating based on the foundational assumption that Indigenous peoples have their power, strength, and competency to develop culturally specific strategies for their communities. We are dedicated to honoring Indigenous self-determination, history, and culture, and are committed to moving forward in the spirit of reconciliation and respect with all First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Beyond the Stethoscope, a podcast focused on hospice palliative care. Today, my guest is Sue Martin, who is a nurse consultant at the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network, a wonderful colleague who has worked for the network for many years. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you, Linda.
And today, Sue and I will be discussing patient preparedness for death. Sue has reviewed many articles regarding the topic and spoken to many community partners regarding the same. So let's get started, Sue.
Okay.
So obviously I've introduced what we'll be talking about today. And why did you choose this topic to discuss?
Well, patient preparedness for death. I just found this topic to be quite fascinating because there's so many layers to it. It can be very complex. For instance, in thinking about preparing for death, we need to understand what a good death looks like. Everyone is unique. My experiences are different from yours, Linda. And so therefore, each person's preparation for death is also unique. I hope that by understanding how best to support one who is dying through the process of preparing for their death, we, the healthcare provider, can improve our overall care to patients at their end of life. Hopefully, we can increase awareness to others about the topic of death and dying, and also help to reduce the stigma associated with palliative care.
That would be fantastic, Sue, because as we know, that is what our role is every day, to increase awareness to others on the topic of death and dying.
Exactly.
Can you explain what is death preparedness?
Well, according to an article that I reviewed, it was published in the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management in June 2022, and it's titled Sufficient Death Preparedness Correlates to Better Mental Health, Quality of Life, and End-of-Life Care. And they say preparedness for death is a multidimensional construct. Cognitive, emotional, and practical preparation for death requires transitions of knowledge and attitudes into an intertwined awareness and acceptance of one's forthcoming death. In this article, the authors evaluated Associations of Cancer Patients' death preparedness states by conjoint cognitive prognostic awareness and emotional preparedness for death with psychological distress, quality of life, and the end-of-life care received. The article talks about PA, which is prognostic awareness, and that having an accurate prognostic awareness or understanding is a prerequisite for cognitive preparedness for death. Emotional preparedness for death reflects emotionally accepting one's dying role, becoming realistic about the limitations of the present circumstances, and relinquishing one's future that's not attainable, and then closing and reconciling or renewing relationship bonds with loved ones in order to prepare them for life without you, yourself. In this article, they concluded that conjoint cognitive and emotional preparedness for death is associated with cancer patients' lower psychological distress, better quality of life, reduced anti-cancer therapy, and increased hospice care utilization. And we all know that, as you said, an earlier initiation of a palliative approach to care is beneficial for both the patient and the family. And that's part of our role, is to build that awareness. So facilitating accurate prognostic awareness and emotional preparedness for death is appropriate when it's consistent with that patient's circumstances and preferences. Two other articles that I reviewed supported the idea that death preparedness, both emotional and cognitive, were important in reducing psychological distress and better quality of life. One of the articles was published in the American Journal of Pain and Symptom Management in 2019, and it's titled Courses of Change in Good Emotional Preparedness for Death and Accurate Prognostic Awareness and Their Associations with Psychological Distress and Quality of Life in Terminally Ill Cancer Patients' Last Year of Life. This article was written in the context of emotional preparedness for death being a distinct but related concept to prognostic awareness, or PA. Both allow patients to prepare psychologically and interpersonally for death. The objectives were to, one, explore the courses of change in good emotional preparedness for death and accurate prognostic awareness, and two, evaluate their associations with severe anxiety symptoms, severe depressive symptoms, and quality of life in the cancer patients last year. In their conclusion, it was found that good emotional preparedness for death and accurate prognostic awareness remained largely stable and improved substantially in cancer patients' last year of life. Both measures were significantly associated with psychological distress, and that healthcare professionals should not only cultivate accurate prognostic awareness, but also promote cancer patients' emotional preparedness for death, which may improve their psychological well-being. Similarly, the other article that I referenced is in 2022, an article found in the American Journal of Pain and Symptom Management titled Terminally Ill Cancer Patients' Emotional Preparedness for Death is Distinct from Their Accurate Prognostic Awareness. And this article looked at the concepts of emotional preparedness for death and prognostic awareness as a distinct but related concept. The authors concluded that both contribute to patients' practical, psychological, and interpersonal preparations for death. Part of their conclusion stated that the healthcare professionals should not only cultivate cancer patients' accurate PA, or prognostic awareness, but also facilitate emotional preparation for death to achieve a good death and improve end-of-life quality care.
So through your research and review of the articles, you've confirmed that death preparedness, both cognitive and emotional, can help one achieve a good death. But what actually is a good death?
That's a good question. According to an Institute of Medicine report, a good death is free from avoidable distress and suffering for the patient, family, and caregivers, in general accord with the patient's and family's wishes, and reasonably consistent with clinical, cultural, and ethical standards. So what is a good death? Well, another article that I was having a look at called Defining a Good Death, Successful Dying. It was published in the American Journal of Geriatric Psychiatry in April 2016. And they felt that at that time, there was very little agreement about what constituted a good death or successful dying. So the authors completed a literature review on 36 studies. They identified 11 core themes of a good death. So they were preferences for specific dying process, pain-free status, religiosity or spirituality, emotional well-being, life completion, treatment preferences, dignity, family, quality of life, and the relationship with the healthcare provider. The top three themes or critical components were preferences for the dying process. So this included the death scene. So who would attend? What is the location of the death? How might it occur? Many people wanted to die during their sleep. And when might that occur? It also included the cognitive preparations for death, such as advanced directives or funeral arrangement. The second theme was for a pain-free status, and they repeatedly heard, "I don't want to die in pain." The third theme was emotional well-being, and that meant having the things that you wanted to have taken care of before you die all completed so that you can be at peace with it. Interestingly, though, the healthcare providers determined that a good death was good symptom management. Dialogues among the stakeholders for each individual really must take place to ensure a good death from the most critical viewpoint, which is the patient's viewpoint. Another article that I read from Crossroads Hospice and Palliative Care supported the above three themes. In this article, it noted that there were five main elements to a good death and that most people agreed on. The first one was to be able to direct their final days, which includes the place of death and when treatment will shift from curative treatment to comfort care. Patients reported that having true informed consent on their current condition and prognosis allowed them to say and do the things that were important to them in their final days. And this supports the first theme of preferences for the dying process. Mm-hmm. The second was a sense of completion, a life review, knowing that they lived a good life and accomplished the goals that were important for them. In the religious or spiritual context, having assurance that past sins were forgiven or taking comfort in cultural or religious rituals. And this supported the third theme as far as emotional well-being. The third component that they noted was being free of pain. And then the fourth one was maintaining their dignity and provided respect. And the fifth was having the support of loved ones. So now we know that there are three main components to a good death in quotation marks. And this knowledge will assist us as healthcare providers and guide us in supporting our patients to achieve death preparedness through their final journey. We really need to ensure that we understand the patient's preferences for the dying process. Where do they wish to live? Who would be present? Ensuring conversations have taken place about the dying person's wishes, their funeral planning, their relationships, and make sure that those conversations take place really early in our relationship with them. We need to ensure that they're pain-free. I would say that we need to ensure that all the symptoms are well managed, for sure. We also need to ensure that our patient's emotional well-being has been addressed. And I find this to be most difficult myself. I don't know about you, Linda, but this is a tough one for me. There's such stigma in our society around death. Fear of death and dying is very real. And sometimes it's referred to as death anxiety. According to another research article that I reviewed called Defining a Good Death or Successful Dying, and it was published in the American Journal of Geriatric Psychiatry in April 2016. Some responses from the patients included that thinking about death and dying made them feel afraid and depressed. So that's a concern.
For sure. So we know in our care, Sue, we try and be as holistic as possible, sure, and look at the whole person and their family. So we try and manage all of these things. What I find incredibly astounding is the next topic that you're going to talk about, which is death anxiety. And I'll get you to explain that. What I find is when patients or clients are prepared for a good death, it's interesting how there's a decrease in death anxiety, but I'm going to see if that's what you actually found as you read through your articles and if you could explain that.
Sure. Thank you. So what is death anxiety? In 2022, the Journal of Palliative Medicine published an article titled Death Anxiety and Correlates in Cancer Patients Receiving Palliative Care. The author stated that death anxiety is powerful, potentially contributes to suffering, and yet has to date not been extensively studied in the context of palliative care. Availability of a validated death anxiety and distress scale, DADDS or DADS, opens the opportunity to better assess and redress death anxiety and serious illness. Their objectives were to explore death anxiety or distress for associations with physical and psychosocial factors. And their conclusions suggest that further research on death anxiety and prognostic awareness in the context of palliative medicine is in order. Findings also raised questions around the optimal nature and timing of spiritual and psychosocial interventions, something that might entail evaluation or screening for death anxiety and prognostic awareness for maximizing the effectiveness of care. So in my mind, having a validated tool to screen for death anxiety early in our provision of care is one strategy to ensure that we're supporting our patients' death preparedness.
So how can we actually manage support around death anxiety?
Good question. This prompted me to look at some other articles and have some discussion around managing death anxiety. So there's a number of strategies available to support death anxiety. And I came across an article from Progress in Palliative Care, Science and the Art of Caring. And it was published in January 2022, titled The Therapeutic Potential of Psychedelic Substances in Hospice and Palliative Care. In it, the author reports a resurgence of interest in the effects and applications of psychedelic therapies. They say, the authors say, that the healthcare field and society at large are witnessing a resurgence of interest in the effects and application of psychedelic therapies in a wide range of settings. Back in the 1950s and 60s, research was conducted in the healthcare setting to explore different applications for psychedelics, such as LSD and mescaline. However, due to regulatory, political, and social issues in the 1970s, psychedelic research was dramatically reduced. With the resumption of studies involving psychedelics, mostly since the 2000s, several studies have taken place investigating the therapeutic potential of these substances, including in patients with serious diseases. I find this very interesting, this topic.
Right, primarily since we grew up in the...
yeah, exactly. Primarily in the fields of hospice and palliative care, assisted psychedelic therapies have been investigated as a potential novel therapeutic modality because preliminary evidence suggested their profound impact on psychological, existential, and spiritual outcomes in patients with serious diseases. Results indicate that psychedelic experiences in a controlled setting can catalyze psychological processes associated with illness and fear of death, promoting therapeutic effects that impact the physical, mental, and spiritual spheres, thus representing a possible therapeutic tool for providing care to our critically ill patients. The author in this article concluded saying the healthcare system and services can improve the end-of-life experience by not merely medicating the dying process, but by humanizing it and understanding it as part of the life cycle. Although improvements have been achieved in the control of pain and distressing symptoms related to serious diseases, there is still much to be developed, especially in the care of psychological and spiritual dimensions, not only of patients in hospice and palliative care, but also of their caregivers. In the context of death, attention to suffering in all of its presentations is an inevitable aspect of holistic care. Thus, the development of meaning-creating psychotherapies, psychospiritual patient care, and further research findings in psychedelic therapies may contribute to more compassionate and mindful care in hospice and palliative care settings. There was a second article, and it's titled The Potential of Psychedelics for End-of-Life and Palliative Care. It was published in the Current Topics in Behavioral Neurosciences book series in December 2021. And in this article, it was agreed that end-of-life and palliative care has improved in recent decades, but they stated that psychopharmacological options available to clinicians and patients in these contexts remain very limited. In particular, psychological factors such as depression, existential distress, and well-being remain challenging to address with current medications. In their article, they reviewed recent research on the use of psychedelics in clinical settings with a particular focus on patients with life-threatening diagnoses. They suggested that psychedelics may provide clinicians with an additional psychopharmacological treatment in the context of end-of-life and palliative care. Very interesting, eh?
That is very interesting. Since years ago, we never even would have thought of the use of medical marijuana or anything like that. So it'll be interesting to see in the years to come how psychedelics may improve treatment at the end of life. Mm-hmm. And what are some of the other modalities to help with death anxiety?
Oh, well, there are other modalities that people do explore to help with death anxiety and develop their emotional preparedness for death, one of which include exploring their own spiritual beliefs. This may be religious and or spiritual beliefs that which can also include cultural or cultures, rituals, or traditions. We can access our interdisciplinary team to help, as I did when speaking with Sheila Atkinson. Sheila is a certified spiritual care practitioner. She's a grief support coordinator at the Hospital for Sick Children. In the past, Sheila provided support as a spiritual advisor working with community partners in the Barrie area, which is where I first met her. And we have had some really good conversation around death preparedness. She told me that we companion the dying, and suggested that we find ways to express curiosity about their spiritual framework or resources. One example of how to approach this that I really liked and found comfortable to use is to ask, is there a spiritual or philosophical perspective that's important to you as you face your death? So I kind of like that wording. Having access to community partners to provide support for the patient on their spiritual journey is a huge benefit. Sheila and others like her have a wealth of knowledge for us to learn from and therefore be better prepared to support our patient's preparation for death. There's an article that was published in the American Journal of Bioethics in December 2019 titled Psychotherapy at End of Life. So this is another option for our patients to support our patients. And in this article, two well-established psychotherapies for patients at end of life, dignity therapy and meaning-centered psychotherapy, were reviewed in great detail. This review speaks to the progress of psychotherapy research with patients at end of life, and this began in the aftermath of Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's seminal book on death and dying. The authors of this article say that while content structure and empirical foundation underlying end of life psychotherapies have evolved considerably in the 50 years since that book was published, her recommendations for providing a non-judgmental space for open discussion of fears and concerns around death and dying remains a cornerstone of these interventions. Whether through dignity therapy, meaning-centered psychotherapy, or other interventions that draw on existential principles, patients who are navigating the demands of an uncertain future both require and deserve state-of-the-art interventions. The goal of attenuating suffering and helping patients and their families to maintain a sense of meaning, dignity, and peace is central to this work. Unfortunately, though, not all healthcare sectors have access to social workers or other professionals who have training in psychotherapy.
Yeah, that's certainly unfortunate, although we do have access to some resources that we can refer patients or clients to. I, like you said, some don't have access to these type of professionals. So that's very unfortunate. Mm-hmm. So how do we utilize the resources that we do have at hand to empower healthcare providers to support our patients on their journey to death preparedness?
Education is key. Learning about those essential conversations is definitely an asset. And some suggestions that I came across, some wording might be to actually start where the person is, saying something like, you have always told me that you are living in hope and focusing on living, but then trying to normalize the conversation as well. Many people find that they struggle with having to start thinking about how they would like to die. Another phrase might be that other families have told me they feel badly about planning a funeral when their loved one is still alive. Some conversation starters may include acknowledging the ambiguity. So it's really hard to look in two directions at once, right? The end and then the beginning, perhaps. So acknowledge the emotion and allow them options. We can talk about this now, or we can talk about this at a later date, and providing a time for that. Another way that we can support our patients on their journey for death preparedness is to utilize the tools that we have available. We have so many resources online, so making ourselves aware of those tools and utilizing them is valuable. The other thing is to make sure that we're aware of our own thoughts and feelings about death preparedness. Remembering that as professionals, volunteers, and caregivers supporting someone in being ready to die, we also come face to face with our own dying and our own mortality. And some situations hit a lot closer to home than others. So something else to consider, another strategy, is in sharing our stories, right? We tell stories all the time in palliative care. In Dr. Marilyn Mendoza's article titled, What Impact Do End-of-Life Experiences Have on Grief? How Extraordinary Experiences at the Deathbed Change the Living. And this was published in March 16th, 2022. And she talks about deathbed visions and dreams of the dying. These are experiences the dying have in which they report seeing and visiting with deceased family members, religious figures, or seeing beautiful scenery. The content and impact of these experiences were found to be very similar. The only real difference is that one occurs when the person is asleep and the other when awake. In the past, deathbed visions, or DBVs, and deathbed dreams, DBDs, they were dismissed as delusions and hallucinations. Rather than exploring these experiences, patients were often medicated, and families were told to ignore the dying person's words as they were just ramblings. Dr. Mendoza says, we now know that these are common experiences occurring around the world, regardless of age, sex, or religion. So her research showed that these experiences can have a positive impact on all involved, not just at the deathbed. Dr. Christopher Kerr, he's a physician at the Hospice Buffalo, and he helps lead the research team to learn and understand more about end-of-life experiences, or ELEs. They report that 88.1% of patients report having at least one end-of-life experience. 99% of patients report their end-of-life experiences as seeming or feeling real. 60.1% of patients felt their dreams were comforting, while 18.8% felt that they were distressing. And they also found that as patients approached end-of-life, there was often an increase in the frequency of comforting visits. I hear that all the time on my travels.
About the dreams too?
Yeah, all different experiences, yeah. Dreams commonly feature deceased loved ones or travel, so preparing to go somewhere. Sometimes they featured living loved ones or pets or animals, religious figures, and past meaningful experiences. The most comforting end-of-life experiences were about deceased loved ones. And then based on Warden's task of mourning, they found that caregivers reporting that their loved ones experienced a comforting end-of-life experience were more accepting of their loss. They were better able to work through the pain of grief. They were better able to adjust to a world without their loved one. And they felt that they had a stronger continuing bond with their loved one. So it's been proven to be effective and helpful to share the stories of end-of-life experiences. These sharings of stories comfort the patient, but also the family. And I think sometimes the staff as well, the caregivers.
Yeah, I would be really interested in some of those stories.
Yeah. Well, you get a bunch of nurses together and you'll hear them. Some other ways to support patients' preparedness for death is, again, utilize the interprofessional team. We have a great resource in our hospice volunteers. David McGinley is a chaplain who wrote a book in 2017 titled Beyond Surviving Cancer and Your Spiritual Journey. And he says that what people fear most is not the dying, it's the leaving. Leaving loved ones, the not being part of their stories. Our hospice volunteers are able to connect with patients to develop relationships and trust at end of life. These caring individuals provide support to the patient to aid in the leaving. The legacy work is so helpful to so many. Unfortunately, many times there just isn't enough time to allow development of that trust and relationship. But the time spent with the hospice volunteer is so valuable. Not just the intellectual relationship, though, but also the heartfelt relationships that develop. Many times, though, I hear that there's a lack of follow-up after the death occurs, which impacts or can impact the volunteer's ability to reflect on and appreciate the value of their involvement. Sharing resources is another way to better support our patients. Bereavement Ontario Network shared this resource just last month. It's called the Exit Interview. And it can assist your patient in preparing for death. It includes questions to pose to assist a person through that process of emotional preparedness. There are some really great questions that we as healthcare providers can pose to our patients, but it's also a great manner in which the patients can use for self-reflection. So our conversation today confirms that patients view emotional well-being as a critical component of a successful death, as do family members and healthcare providers. Although it's important that we attend to the patient's physical symptoms, such as pain control, it is crucial that the healthcare system expand the care beyond treating these symptoms and more closely address psychological, social, religiosity, spirituality themes in end-of-life care for both patients and families. Patients view the end-of-life and death preparedness as encompassing not only the physical components of death, but also psychosocial and spiritual concerns. So in conclusion, we understand that our palliative patient's death preparedness is comprised of emotional preparedness for death and prognostic awareness or cognitive preparedness. Each of these factors contribute to the patient's practical, psychological, and interpersonal preparations to achieve a good death.
I would agree with that conclusion too. I think it's information that most of us who have worked in hospice palliative care for many years would say that it's implied, but it's really nice that the research is there, because obviously that helps with if there's funding needed or the system needs to change. And are there any final thoughts or suggestions on ways to prepare for death?
Well, something that I read that really resonated with me, it said, acknowledge the important people in your life. Remember treasured moments in your own life. Apologize to those you love if you have hurt them. Forgive those who love you if they have hurt you. Express your gratitude for all the love and care you have received. Tell your friends and family how much you love them, and take a moment to say goodbye.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I would just like to add one more thing for healthcare providers. I remember when I first came to the network, obviously you and Inga de Bruin have worked for the network and have done hospice palliative care for many, many years. And I remember having a discussion with you both. And one of the statements that I will never forget that has impacted the way I practice or I teach so much is just the simple statement of meet the patient and the family where they're at, rather than trying to come up with all these complex care plans and so on. The place to start is meet the patient and family where they're at. So I think that's really good advice to pass along. So thank you to you and Inga for that advice that I've just passed along.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you, Linda.
So I just want to say thank you, Sue. That was fantastic information, and you did obviously a tremendous amount of research for the podcast today. And so I just want to say thank you very much. And it was totally informative and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Great. Thank you. It was very interesting to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. Talk soon.